Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, some pretty gloomy news here to start off. Are Canadian businesses closing at an alarming rate?
Unfortunately, yes. It's terrible. It's the fastest rate, one of the fastest rates we've ever seen outside of the pandemic. One in 20 businesses close in the last month in Canada. And the trend has been going up for quite some time. And I think, you know, you and I were just talking before the call about your area and my area, and it's something that you can literally see with your eyes if you look. There's a lot, especially in the restaurant space, closing because we've seen consumers retrenching in the higher rate environment with the record debt levels that they have. They've been pulling back on everything discretionary, and that includes food spending, restaurant spending. You know, that's food companies are all reporting their revenues are down, their outlooks are revising down, their share prices are dropping. So there's just this theme of less spending out of households, and that's pretty prevalent. Even in, you know, relatively affluent areas, people are still pulling back because, as I've mentioned before, people with the higher incomes tend to have borrowed the most money in the last few years and are feeling the pinch now with the higher carrying costs of everything. So that's not good because, you know, small to medium-sized businesses are who create the bulk of the job growth in the country. And so indeed we're seeing, you know, there's been a hiring strike now for some time where businesses weren't hiring, but we're now seeing a pickup in layoffs as well. And the change in the job vacancy rate has fallen significantly in both primarily in the private sector, and the public sector, as you know, the government's been creating a lot of the jobs in the past couple of years, and they've become really top heavy as far as employment, but the official unemployment rate has continued to tick up. So, you know, we're at 6.6%, up from 4.8% in June of 22, and we've actually never seen an increase of like a percent in the unemployment rate in Canada where you weren't already in a recession. So the fact that we're up about 180 basis points is already alarming in itself, and then you've got this trend ongoing with the closing of more businesses. So I think, you know, again, I've mentioned this before, it's great that we're into the cutting portion of the cycle in terms of interest rates, with the Bank of Canada having already eased from 5% to 4.25%, and they are expected to keep cutting. And the U.S. Fed finally started, as you know, with a 50 beeper in its last meeting, and there's more cuts expected in 2024 and 2025. The thing is, it's the lag time and the filtering through time. It doesn't happen instantly, right? The average mortgage rate outstanding in the United States is about 3.89% right now. So even if you've got mortgage rates that have come down from above 7 to around 6, you're still significantly higher than anything that we've seen in the past several years. And certainly, if anyone's got debt coming up for renewal or wants to change their property, and that involves, you know, especially in the United States, porting mortgages is not a thing in the States generally, so you have to qualify for a new mortgage. And as you know, in Canada, it's the similar thing. You know, if you want to change homes and have to consolidate other debts, or you want to buy anything, like trade up to buy something that's more expensive, you're going to need a larger mortgage. And then you've got, you know, the new mortgage rules changing in Canada to try and incent more borrowing and spending in the housing market. And I think these strategies are just flawed because it's a function of what people can afford out of their income. And when you do the math, you know, being able to borrow, you know, 1.3 or 4 million instead of just 1 million and have CMHC coverage is not going to help when you look at the monthly payments relative to the income. So it's just this really bad trend that I think is going to continue for some time. As I've mentioned, once the unemployment rate starts to rise and you get this closing of businesses and insolvencies, which we've really seen a huge leap. In fact, I was just putting the latest Hoyes Mikolov's consumer solvency report for August is, you know, showing an alarming increase in the amount of people that are filing for consumer proposals, which is essentially a way to, you know, cut off debt and put it down to pennies on the dollar and get the creditors to agree to accept, you know, a lesser amount, and you pay it back over time and all that. So that type of consolidation is essential for households that got in too deep and can't pay off their bills. The same goes for corporations, although you typically see them do more of bankruptcy filing and just sort of tabula rasa and start again. And the increase that we've seen in Canada is already vying for the biggest increase we saw in 2009 coming out of the 08 recession. So you got to think about this. That's with the unemployment rate, you know, still under 7%, with the Canadian stock market still near its all-time high. And, you know, so, and interest rates already off the peak. Mortgage rates have already come down significantly from where they were in Canada as well. And yet you're still seeing this, this strain continue to play out. And I think that that's a function of, as I've mentioned, the lag times and the fact that, you know, historically you get, this, it takes a couple of years from when they've started, or 18 months, say, from when they start the cutting cycle to really see any sort of improvement in the overall economic outlook. And when you get into the cutting cycle, it's typical for them to reverse 80 to 90% of what they did in the prior hiking portion. But they don't do that until, you know, there's a lot of pain evident in things like asset markets, real estate, which lead the worst recessions historically. So I think all of these things just suggest that we're in the early innings of the downturn that is likely unfolding.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, China has launched a plan to try to refire their economy. Is it going to be successful, and how's it working out so far?
So this is, you know, China's later along in this balance sheet recession that's been overtaking households and businesses. Again, when you get the most highly levered asset class in the world, which is real estate, in a down cycle that continues for a period of years typically, that has a massive impact on the household sector because that tends to be the most widely held asset. It also has a massive effect on developers, because construction and real estate development being a levered activity, especially in places like China, where after the 2008 recession, there was this huge influx of government incentives to develop real estate and infrastructure, and that drove a commodities rebound globally, and it drove all this spending, but ultimately overinvestment because money was so cheap and easy. So this is really what happened in Canada as well, of course, in the last few years with really cheap and easy money. Too much of it goes into, you know, the real estate sector, and you get this excess supply, overbuild, and over overpricing. So once that starts to reverse, it takes many years typically for it to clear itself, and it does so in the form of both bankruptcies and solvencies, and also in terms of fire sales and, you know, lenders taking back properties and clearance and selling things at big discounts. So that's been going on in China already for about 4 years. And they also had the stock market collapse a couple of times. So, you know, the average worker in China that's trying to get ahead, they have to save a ton. They're saving about 30% of their household income in order to self-fund things like their health care and retirement, because they don't have a very good safety net, not like in the West. So households know that they're responsible for their own basically personal needs. And so they have this huge saving component. Their household income in general is still quite small relative to Western-led countries. And so the masses try and do things like speculate on assets to try and get ahead. So they did that in the stock market. They did that in real estate. And now both have been falling for many years. So this really wipes out consumer confidence in speculation activities. And they go back to just building up savings wherever possible in banks and cash deposits and things like, you know, gold bullion or whatever they can that they think will be a store of value that won't hopefully implode like what they've been experiencing. So in terms of the Chinese stock market, when they stepped in with these new ideas, they keep bringing these iterations of, you know, lowering the base rate in the banking system or incentivizing more types of borrowing by city officials, municipalities, this kind of thing, to try and get people to, you know, take more loans and build more stuff. The problem is that it's hurt people repeatedly over and over, so as I say, they lose their interest in it. And the Chinese stock market, the Shanghai Composite, has gone up 25% in the past 2 weeks just on these, you know, initiatives, the euphoria around, oh boy, you know, the bazooka's out, now they're gonna save everyone, backstop everything. But we've seen this story, as I say, repeatedly, and the stock market today, even though it's gone up 25%, is only back to where it was in like 2020, in June of 2020, and March 2007 before that, Jim. So if you remember back to 2007, the China mania story was a huge part and parcel of the commodities mania that was going at that time, and it was all also driven by the housing bubble in the United States, where there'd been all this over demand for hard rocks and you know, lumber and all this stuff to build an oversupply in housing. So it was all connected. And now, you know, it remains to be seen, but so far there's not much on the fiscal side. There's no direct transfers of cash into households like we saw during the pandemic, for example, which drove a big jump in actual spending in the economy and, you know, artificially inflated GDP for a while in many countries. We are not seeing that yet in China. So far, they're just trying to stimulate more loan growth and get consumers to take risk again. And we'll see the extent that that's successful. There's been some, you know, institutional investment of money flows going into the Chinese stock market on this rationale that, you know, it's cheaper. It's relatively quite cheap to places like America, where, you know, the long term, the S&P 500 is like some 180% above its long term trend line. So it's one of the most outrageously expensive stock markets in the world, 33 times its Cap A, you know, smooth Shiller PE ratio and all that stuff. So everyone knows the U.S. is heinously expensive, and they look around and go, well, where can we put capital? Okay, relatively speaking, somewhere like the Chinese market is cheaper. But again, it remains to be seen whether this has any follow-through, because ultimately you can't prop up an economy just by inflating the value of some assets for a few people. The stock market is not widely held by the masses. You know, it's a very small share of the North American population even has stock market exposure to any significant degree, and less even in China. So really, you've got to find a way to improve productivity in the economy. You've got to find a way to get debt levels down so that there is free cash flow. You have to get it to a point where people are earning more organically in their income, because that is really what drives longer-term spending, investment, and growth in the economy. And so far, we haven't seen any of that.
Toronto home prices down as houses flood the market. Is this what was going to happen when Toronto at one time had a record number of construction cranes, more than the top 10 cities in the U.S. combined?
Yes, and there's still a ton of property building underway. So, you know, it has a long duration, that stuff. It doesn't turn on a dime or stop suddenly when demand turns down. So I was just tracking this because I've been following, of course, the listings in the Toronto area on a daily basis. Just since May, they're up about 43%. Now, you know that during the summer, it's supposed to be, you know, a high demand period so that people tend to move before year end and that sort of thing. Well, we didn't see, we've seen some demand, but as interest rates have been cut, there has been some revitalization of interest. But the problem is that prices remain obscene. So, you know, more than $1 million is the average home price in the GTA, and that's off only about 5% year over year. And of course, the average Vancouver price is almost $1.2 million, as you know, and that's off about 1.8 year over year. But new listings in September were up 50% month over month. So here's the point: is that so many people got in over their skis when interest rates were at ultra lows, you know, when they were getting mortgages for sub 3%, that even though, you know, you can now renew or get a mortgage around the 5% or less area, it's still the price that's the problem relative, again, to the income, because income levels haven't increased nearly enough. And as I said, now we're in the layoff phase of the cycle, so we're seeing a lot of people falling behind on payments and just giving up in many cases. But in terms of consumer confidence, the 87% of Americans say it's a bad time to buy a house, and that the conditions in Canada are even worse, right, because our home prices are significantly higher than theirs. It's also a bad time to buy motor vehicles because, again, interest rates and the price of the vehicles are so high that we've seen actually flat buying year over year, which is quite a red flag considering the population growth has increased, of course, in both America and Canada. So to see things like these major ticket items where sales are moribund and people just aren't interested, the transaction volume in September in Toronto was 30% below the 10-year average for the month of September. So 30% lower is quite a lot. And, you know, as I said, there's been some buying activity, but the listings are going up three times faster than the sales. And I think that's going to continue because this is all, you know, we saw this play out in Japan in the late 80s when they had this massive bubble in housing as well as the stock market and all this leverage and borrowing against these assets that then collapsed. You saw this happening in China the past few years. And now it's, I think, you know, a similar trend going on. We saw it in the United States after their 06-07 bubble where property prices fell for many years and ultimately corrected about 30% nationally and then didn't recover for many years after that. And the same in Canada. You know, we have the readings that we're looking at, whether it's, you know, the like I say, the leading indicators, the rising unemployment rate, the consumer confidence numbers, you know, jobs hard to get share versus those who say they were able to change jobs has leapt to levels typically commensurate with past recessions. The yield curve has re-steepened again. You typically get yield curves when they go from, you know, lower rates below long rates, you get an upward sloping yield curve again. When you typically get that, you usually see a recession within 3 months, and that has now happened. We have a positive sloping 210 curve in Canada and America, and the inversion period before that was, you know, almost 2 years long. It was the longest period of inversion that we'd seen since 1927 to 29, and that should also perk people's ears up to know that we had a major, you know, credit implosion with lasting marks on the economy and the real estate market, et cetera, and the stock market after the 29 peak, of course. So, you know, it's not really, you know, I don't enjoy regaling people with this really, you know, bearish warning. But the problem is that the math is what it is. The readings are what they are. The choices that have been made have been all bad, short-term orientated. How do we goose consumption, non-productive consumption? How do we make things more expensive? You know, so now we've got a lot. The inflation rate in Canada came down below 2% in the latest reading. So that's the first time that's happened. So great, Bank of Canada on target. Now, on the other side of that, we have a couple of other concerns with respect to inflationary impulses, right? Which is, one is this big port shutdown, which of course no one knows how long this is going to last. Now, again, we have high inventory levels of most goods because supply has been outstripping demand for many months here already. So in a lot of sectors, we've got an abundance of inventory on hand, which has in the short run been supportive of GDP and economic expansion as, you know, people stockpiled, companies stockpiled, wholesalers, manufacturers, retailers were stockpiling. Going into the year end, you know, retailers typically do that for the Christmas season. But now we have this issue with respect to how long this port strike is going to last. There's geopolitical issues in the Middle East where you've seen the price of oil spike, you know, about 5%, almost 5% in just today. Now, having said that, it's still very low relative to where it was. You know, it's about half the level it was when the Ukraine war invasion happened, et cetera. So there's this, you know, OPEC is warning that if they don't get more cuts in production by their cohort in their group with them, the petroleum producing nations, that the price of oil is going to go to $50. It typically goes to about $40 if we get into a recession. So I just think there's a couple of risks right now with respect to the Middle East where we don't know how long that's going to last in terms of inflationary impulse. There's the port strike. We don't know how long that's going to last in terms of inflationary impulse. But we do know that in past events, things like the hurricane in Florida, similarly, you get a disruption to the economy in the short run, but then eventually you get a catch-up period where things mean revert after that, and it usually corrects itself pretty quickly. So again, it's more like a cyclical impact than a long-term secular force. Meanwhile, the long-term secular force that we have is the aging demographic, the over-indebted population, the extremely over-inflated housing, which is a drag on the economy, which is counterproductive for productivity, which suggests we've got too many things and too many people employed, right? So I think that the next wave of this, we had record profit margins for companies that are at all-time highs for the largest companies in the world. That's typically a mean reverting series. So not only have investors paid ridiculous prices for, you know, the assets of these companies on the growth outlook going forward, but they've also paid record multiples at record profits. So this suggests that you should see a mean reversion in the profit impulse over the next couple of years. You should also then have a re-sobering or a re-examination of the prices that were paid of those earnings multiples. Like I said, historically in this period, you get a period of disappointment with respect to economic growth and everything kind of gets revised down. So we'll see. No one has a crystal ball. No one knows how long this can last. But we do know for sure that it is fundamentally unsupported, that it is speculation, that it is gambling, that it is financially destructive in the longer run. It's just a question of how long it can be propped and prodded to continue.
In an effort to be more efficient, will companies that have laid off people replace those laid off people with AI so there are no jobs to return to or fewer jobs to return to once the recession is over?
Well, this is certainly another risk factor that is unknowable at this time. You know, I read a lot stuff on this topic and look at all kinds of metrics, and certainly AI is here to stay, just like computers were, just like the internet was. You know, it's here to stay. It will have long impacts in terms of what we do in terms of practices of businesses and individuals and households, for sure. And there's no doubt it's going to replace some workers. The question is that something that happens over the next 1, 2, 3 years? Is that something that happens over the next 10 years? To what extent has it been priced into current assets? To what extent has the euphoria overpriced the upside in terms of what it's going to mean for, again, the things that matter in the long run are productivity gains, stored wealth, not speculation in asset bubbles that burst and, you know, like carbuncles leave big holes. We're talking about, you know, things that are sustainable. And to the extent that AI creates sustainable productivity enhancement in the economy, that will be good in the longer run, great. But the caveat there is if we are continuing to see unemployment rise here, and as you correctly point out, if companies are coming into a period of compressed revenues, which is typically affiliated with this kind of environment, compressed revenues, then automatically they're going to look for efficiency improvements. If they can replace, you know, some of their overhead costs by picking up a piece of equipment or software or application, clearly they're going to do that, right? So that will definitely be part of this process. It's just figuring out to, you know, exactly how and who that's going to impact the most is quite a guessing game.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.